Wednesday, the 21st day of December, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Now coming up, Catalonians head to the polls in regional elections.
I hope during these historic elections, we can achieve historic participation.
Also ahead, a UN official says people are dying because the Syrian government will not give the green light for an urgent medical evacuation. And what does it take to decorate New York for the holidays? It's all ahead on International Edition. Voters in Spain's Catalonia region are back at the polls today, choosing members of their regional parliament. It's an election that was called for after the separatist lawmakers made a unilateral declaration of independence in October. And joining me on the line from Barcelona is reporter Henry Ridgewell. Henry, can you describe the scene in the mood of the elections today?
Well, this election is taking place against the backdrop of a very heated campaign, which has taken place in the wake of that disputed referendum on independence in October. Following that referendum, the Madrid government seized control of the Catalonian Assembly and jailed many of the leaders of the independence movement. And that jailing has been a central tenet of the pro-independence parties here, who say what Madrid has done is against democracy and is morally wrong, and therefore trying to whip up anger against Madrid to gain support for their positions and for their pro-independence parties. On the other side, you have the pro-unity parties who want to remain part of Spain, who want Catalonia to stay in the union. They say that this is just a distraction, that Catalonia already enjoys a large level of autonomy. It has its own police force, its own parliament, and so on, and that any attempt to break away from Spain would really hit the Catalan economy hard. Finally, we're at election day, and the turnout so far appears to be quite high. We won't know, of course, until the end of the day.
What about the overall ramifications of the election and the political turmoil in the region?
Well, there's a dispute over whether this is really going to solve the problems that Catalonia faces. This independence campaign has been built over several years, and it all came to a head in October with this disputed referendum. And there's little prospect, really, that the result tonight is going to make all that go away. It appears as though, from polls, that the vote is going to be pretty evenly split between pro-independence and pro-unity parties. So there is the prospect that tomorrow we're going to be none the wiser as to where Catalonia is going, whether its people want independence or not. In the meantime, that stalemate, that political paralysis is leading to a lot of questions here over the future of the economy, for example. Catalonia is Spain's richest region, and much of the independence campaign has been built on that. But businesses here say, well, they don't know if Catalonia is going to be part of Spain. They don't know if they can continue trading with Spain or indeed the European Union.
A lot of big questions over what the future may hold for businesses in the region. But elections fundamentally are about the people who live there, who have to live and breathe the ramifications of voting, of the vote results every single day. What are they saying as they go to the polls?
Well, it is very divided, and it really depends who you speak to. You see passionate arguments breaking out on the streets. We were interviewing some of the voters outside the polling booths today, and one pro-unity supporter was outlining his point of view, and another person in the line butted in and wanted to have an argument there with him, somebody who supported independence. So for a nation that I suppose is renowned for its passionate, heated debate and so on, we're seeing that really played out in politics now, and the hope is that we won't see the violence again that we saw around that disputed referendum with the heavy police crackdown in October. But as you say, many questions will remain from tomorrow, it appears. Once the result comes late tonight, around midnight local time, if not a little bit before.
Henry Ridgewell is in Barcelona, joining me by phone, keeping us abreast of the election that's taking place in Spain's Catalonia region. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And those polls are expected to close around 1900 hours universal time in Catalonia. And now in the studio with me is VOA social media correspondent Andrew Palczewski. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
So what are the interwebs saying this hour?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the hashtag UNGA, the UN General Assembly, set to vote on a Jerusalem status resolution on Thursday after the U.S. vetoed a Security Council vote to condemn the U.S. decision to recognize Jerusalem instead of Tel Aviv as the capital of Israel. Lots of talk about the vote and where different countries will side, people noting that in a vote earlier this week on the status of Palestinian people to self-determination, every country voted yes except for the U.S., Canada, and several small island nations. So a lot of people handicapping the vote. They think it's going to be a very lopsided vote when it does occur. And there's a lot of discussion online about the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, what she meant when she said today that the U.S. wouldn't forget being singled out on the world stage.
Right. And not only that, earlier this week, she sent that letter to the UN at large. President Trump yesterday made the comments backing up Haley, even taking it further. And then in Haley's address at the UN today, she upped the ante once more. So people are watching what the United States is saying at the UN as other leaders have been making their addresses as well.
Yeah, and after Haley's comments on social media, there's a lot of speculation about if the U.S. could withdraw foreign aid as a result of this vote, what the impact of these comments might be, and the vote might be on the United States' reputation worldwide, especially as a lot of people are noting other countries are coming to the podium there at the UNGA and essentially lecturing the United States about this position. So we'll have to see as this continues to unfold. High drama at the UN in New York.
Absolutely. Andrew Palczewski, our social media correspondent, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Additionally, at this other, here are some other stories from around the globe. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is disappointed that Myanmar has failed to cooperate with the world's body staff. Russia said Thursday that the new U.S. sanctions against five Russians are illegal and unfriendly. And the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia is likely to reciprocate. And less than a month after a military intervention forced longtime leader Robert Mugabe to step down, the new leaders of the ruling ZANU-PF party have big plans for Zimbabwe. For in-depth coverage to these stories and more 24 hours a day, point your web browser to voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In a new study, scientists from the Technical University of Denmark provide new evidence that cosmic rays play a role in cloud formation, thus affecting our climate. Cosmic rays are a form of fast-moving, high-energy radiation that emanate from the sun or from sources even light years away from our solar system. According to the study, as cosmic rays interact with the atmosphere, they produce ions, charged atomic particles, that help form and grow cloud condensation nuclei, which are particles needed to produce clouds. The Danish scientists write that the number of these cloud condensation nuclei varies whenever ionization in the atmosphere changes. The presence of these particles can alter the properties of clouds, and the study suggests more particles can mean more clouds, a colder climate, and vice versa. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A senior UN official says people are dying because the Syrian government will not give the green light for an urgent medical evacuation in eastern Ghouta, a suburb of Damascus. Now, Lisa Schlein brings us that story.
The United Nations has been asking the Syrian government for permission to transport patients from eastern Ghouta to Damascus for urgent medical treatment since May, to no avail. Special advisor to the UN Syrian envoy, Jan Egelen, says 494 people were on the priority list for medical evacuations drawn up 2 months ago.
That number is going down, not because we're evacuating people, but because they are dying.
At least 400,000 people are trapped in eastern Ghouta, which is besieged by President Bashar al-Assad's regime. UN humanitarian workers have been blocked from delivering food and other critical supplies to the civilians trapped there for months. Because of this deprivation, Egeland says 12% of children in the city are suffering from severe acute malnutrition, and one-third of malnourished children under 5 are stunted. He tells VOA he has confirmation that 16 people have died since the medical evacuation lists were resubmitted in November. But he adds that number is probably higher.
I feared during this Christmas and holiday season, there will be more deaths unless we get the evacuation going. They have to be evacuated to get the treatment they need to save their life.
Eastern Ghouta, which has been under siege since 2013, is only 15 kilometers east of Damascus. Egeland notes the Syrian capital has the hospitals needed to care for the wounded and critically ill patients. He says the city has enormous warehouses full of special nutritional therapeutic foods needed to treat acutely malnourished children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Two men were arrested in Australia after the SUV in which they were traveling rammed into pedestrians on a busy central Melbourne street Thursday, leaving 19 people injured, 4 in critical condition. Samantha Vadas takes it from here.
Chaos in the Australian city of Melbourne. Pedestrians strewn along iconic Flinders Street after a vehicle ploughed through a crowded intersection full of Christmas shoppers on Thursday, injuring at least a dozen people, including a preschool child, and putting the area in lockdown. Police say they've arrested 2 people, including the driver, but haven't given any motive for the incident, which has chilling echoes of a similar case when 4 people were killed in the city in January. It comes after a series of terror-related attacks in Europe where vehicles are used to mow down pedestrians.
Victoria State Police Commissioner Russell Barrett told reporters that police arrived on the scene within minutes and arrested the 2 subjects.
A male driving that car has been stationary and then gone out along the tram tracks, driven intentionally, we will allege, through the intersection with Elizabeth Street, colliding with a large number of pedestrians. That vehicle has then collided. The male has been arrested. He's been arrested by an off-duty police officer at the scene. The person driving the car has resisted arrest and been taken into custody after somewhat of a fight between them. As a result of that occurring, there was also another 24-year-old male in close proximity around that time. That 24-year-old male was seen filming the incident with his mobile phone and also had a bag that had possession of some knives in it. That 24-year-old male was also taken into custody. The offender in this incident, who we're alleging was driving the car, we've reviewed footage and at this stage we're satisfied that he was driving the car without anyone else present at all. He has been taken to hospital as a result of his injuries, as has the police officer.
He also stated that the motive for the incident was not immediately clear.
However, we do not know the motivation, and it is still early stages of the investigation.
Acting Police Commissioner of Victorian Police Shane Patton told reporters they didn't have any evidence or intelligence to indicate a connection with terrorism. Barrett said the suspect was an Australian citizen of Afghan descent and had a history of drug use and mental health issues.
We understand, as I said, this still is very early days, that he is on a mental health plan and receiving treatment for a mental illness. We are working through those to clarify that.
Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull sent a tweet calling the incident shocking and said his thoughts and prayers were with the victims and those treating them. This is VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Poland and the European Union might be headed for a showdown after Warsaw's right-of-center Law and Justice Party approved sweeping legislation to overhaul the courts. It insisted the move is aimed at reforming a corrupt and inefficient judicial system, accountable to no one, and is only following Western models. Warsaw has also placed greater government control over state-run media. The European Commission's vice president, Frans Timmermans, says these reforms pose a threat to democracy and the rule of law.
Sadly, our concerns have deepened. Within a period of 2 years, a significant number of laws have been adopted, 13 in total, which put at serious risk the independence of the judiciary and the separation of powers in Poland. The entire structure of the justice system is affected. Constitutional Tribunal, the Supreme Court, the Ordinary Courts, the National Council for the Judiciary, the Prosecution Service, and the National School of Judiciary. The common pattern of all these legislative changes is that the executive or legislative powers are now set up in such a way that the ruling majority can systematically, politically interfere with the composition, the powers, the administration, and the functioning of these authorities, thereby rendering the independence of the judiciary completely moot.
Timmermans said after 2 years, the commission can only conclude there is now a clear risk of a serious breach of the rule of law and is threatening sanctions, the so-called nuclear option, unless Warsaw changes its course in coming months. The two sides are likely to meet in January for talks, and Bruce Wilson is a professor at RMIT University's European Center in Australia. He told VOA's Victor Beatty, in light of Brexit, political uncertainty in Germany, and the migration crisis, this is just the latest challenge to the soon-to-be 27-member EU.
Clearly, there are other member states, other than Poland, that will be upset by the EU's actions. Hungary is one example.
What is going on in Poland?
Over the last 2 years, there have been a number of legislative actions by the current ruling party which limit the independence of the judiciary. And the view of the European Union is that part of the process of building a democratic society and democratic processes is that the three arms of government, the executive, the judiciary, and the parliament, are independent. I think in the last 2 years, 13 pieces of legislation, according to the EU, have threatened the independence of the judiciary.
What is the PIS, the ruling party's, concern about the judiciary in Poland?
Their public argument is that all that they are doing is modernizing the judicial system in Poland, that they have drawn on examples from other democratic countries such as the United States. But the alternative view of the EU is that the Polish government is limiting the capacity of the courts in Poland to review the actions of the Polish government.
Does this really go at the heart of what European unity is supposed to be like and how far the European Union can go in telling member states what is acceptable and what isn't?
The European Union has a very clear framework of values and of criteria by which any nation can become a member state. The process of testing itself against those criteria takes several years. In the case of Croatia, for example, the most recent new member, it was the best part of 7 or 8 years. When a nation state no longer meets those criteria, this kind of action by the EU is inevitable.
This is being called the EU's nuclear option under Article 7 of the 2009 Lisbon Treaty, marks a major escalation in tensions with so-called Eurosceptics in former communist Eastern Europe. This is a significant showdown, isn't it?
It is potentially a significant showdown. Under the terms of the ruling by the European Union, there are some 3 months in which Poland, as the member state, can respond, or more particularly, I think according to the Commission, it can take action that lessens the Commission's concern about its control of the judiciary.
Wilson said that the sanctions, if implemented, would reduce Polish voting rights in the EU forums and perhaps cut EU funding to the East European country. However, the latter move would require a unanimous EU vote, and Hungary has indicated it cannot do so. So what does it take to get New York ready for the holidays? Well, Faith Lapidus narrates this report.
It takes a lot to get ready for Christmas. And much of the preparation for making New York sparkle takes place about an hour north of the city at American Christmas. The 44,000-hectare warehouse looks like the city's attic, where all sorts of decorations that adorn New York's shopping areas and landmarks during the holidays are stored. It's filled with angels, wreaths, pine cones, candy canes, and lights.
It's gotten a little more sophisticated over time, for sure. The retailers in New York especially get involved with producing and putting up much more elaborate displays than perhaps they did years ago.
The weeks before Christmas are the busiest for the company, as workers hang lights on trees, put the finishing touches on reindeer and toy soldiers, and pack display orders for delivery. American Christmas provides the holiday displays for some of the best-known locations in New York, including Radio City Music Hall and Rockefeller Center, and retail stores like Saks Fifth Avenue and the Salvatore Ferragamo Shoe Store, which got a new design this year.
This shoe that was designed in the 1950s for Ferragamo served as the inspiration for the new design, and this is the new design.
Some of the decorations are produced in factories in China and elsewhere, but they're all assembled into festive masterpieces here in Mount Vernon. The displays that reflect the very distinctive New York style not only bring the spirit of the season to the city's heart, but also tourists and customers with long Christmas shopping lists. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And that is going to do it for today's program. I'd like to thank Patrice Martin for directing today's show, as well as Dan Crafton for engineering the broadcast. And most importantly, I'd like to thank you for listening. Be sure to follow the Voice of America on social media like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for pictures, stories, videos, and more. I am Steve Miller in Washington. You know what? Have an absolutely fantastic day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has announced an additional $130 million in emergency food assistance to Yemen through the U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID. This brings the total U.S. contribution in humanitarian aid for the people of Yemen to nearly $768 million since October 2016. The deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen is a matter of grave concern for the United States. More than 22 million Yemenis are in dire need of assistance, with more than 8 million on the brink of famine, according to the United Nations. The country has been brought to this state because of the conflict that began in 2015, when Houthi rebels, supported by Iran, seized the capital of Sana'a and drove the internationally recognized government into exile. At the request of the Yemeni government, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia began airstrikes on rebel positions to stop their expansion. Not enough critically needed supplies are reaching the suffering Yemeni people. The United States has repeatedly called on the Saudi-led military coalition to facilitate the free flow of humanitarian aid and commercial imports to all of Yemen's ports and through Sana'a Airport. USAID Administrator Mark Green noted that the small amount of goods that Saudi Arabia has let into Yemen so far is not nearly enough to address the tremendous need. In addition to urging Saudi Arabia to allow humanitarian aid to reach all points where it is needed, the White House has also called on the Iranian-backed Houthi militias to allow food, medicine, and fuel to be distributed throughout the areas they control, rather than diverted to sustain their military campaign against the Yemeni people. The United States urges all parties to the conflict in Yemen to immediately cease hostilities, re-energize political talks, and end the suffering of the Yemeni people. As White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said in a press statement earlier this month, the United States continues to believe that the devastating conflict in Yemen and the suffering it causes must be brought to an end through political negotiations, in accordance with relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions. Successful political negotiations are are necessary to ensure that Yemen can flourish, free of the malign influence of Iranian-backed militias operating outside the structures of the state.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.